Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here and coming so early. And Carly, thank you so much for the kind introduction. It is such an honor to be here. And as Carly said, it was 2008 when I was emerging leader from STFM, which means I'm about 25 now. And I'm really excited to be sharing time with you guys. I am so happy to be back. It feels like a homecoming for me. I want to just kind of set the tone again. I just gave you some insight into my age. Usually when I'm talking to groups of younger people, can we go get ahead and get the slides up? One second. Do I need to do something? Okay. All right. So yesterday, my niece and nephew were trying to help me understand Snapchat and ask me why I don't use it. And this is why I don't use it, because I'm in this age group that doesn't quite get it. Before I start, I want to ask everybody to do something. I want you to turn to somebody that you did not come here with and that you don't know, so you might have to go to another table really quickly, and just introduce yourself and use this structure that I have up here. So, good morning, my name is blank, and I blank. So, go ahead, have at it. Someone you don't know, you can come here. And you can bend over backwards like that if you'd like. Please feel free to bend over backwards. Okay. Some of you guys have life stories going on here. Okay, my kids actually bent over backwards to do this, like the thing, because they listened to instructions. So what did you guys hear? Name some things that people said. What did people say? Anything? Where they worked? Where they were from? What else? What they do? Okay, what they like? Anything else? Okay. So isn't it amazing how quickly you can take such a short statement and infuse so much of your identity into it, even without really thinking about it? If I were to ask you to do that all over again, partner with people that you don't know, and say the thing that you most value, and talk about the things that you most care about, would what you said be the exact same? So for me, you know, a lot of times what I say when that opportunity comes up depends on the environment in which I'm in. So some days it goes like this. My name is Dr. Wanda Olaiwala. I'm a family physician, chief clinical transformation officer of Rubicon MD. Or my name is Dr. Wanda Olaiwala. I am the founder of a minority women's empowerment movement called MWPs or MVPs. Or my name is Dr. Wanda Olaiwala. I was previously served as the director of the UCSF Center for Excellence in Primary Care, or the chief medical officer of Community Health Center, Inc. in Connecticut. Or I'm a practice transformation consultant for some health systems in both Australia and New York. Or I'm a doctor and I'm also an author. Some days it would sound something more like this. My most prized possessions, I think, where I went to school, I think you guys heard about that, and The Ohio State University, and very, very excited to have been there. And as you can tell, my family's a little bit diehard for Ohio State football. There are some Buckeyes. Okay, well then, if you're excited about that, wait till you see what I'm about to show you. Are you ready? This is my nephew. And when he was born, this is in the hospital before he was born a few months ago, swaddled in Ohio State clothing, as true Buckeye family would do. But I think the things that I value the most are the fact that I'm Paul's wife, or Darius and Nisi's mom. But depending on who I'm talking to and what I'm saying, thank you. Depending on who I'm talking to, my identity is so much more than what can be described in one sentence. I have a lot of interests and talents and goals. So one sentence really doesn't do it. And I would also say that who I am, it continues to evolve. I am nowhere near where I thought I would be when I was thinking about my career years ago, and I'm certainly not where I hope I'll end up. I hope I will still be moving and evolving over time. So the reason why I think I've been able to do that is because I'm going to challenge you to do something that I've been forced to do and I've been really happy to do and has been made a tremendous, tremendous impact on my career. So I'm going to ask you all to repeat after me. We're going to do a lot of call and response this morning because it's Sunday morning and the people are tired and I need to make sure that you're with me. So first I'm going to say check the boxes, but don't get put in a box. So check the boxes. But don't get put in a box. Okay, so you have to remember that. So we all have these boxes that we want to check in our lives, the things that are important to us, the things that we most value, the things that we hope we're going to achieve, the things that we would be sad if we, you know, get to the end of our road and we did not accomplish. And you may not have thought about them consciously, but they're subconsciously there. So for me, I've had these four kind of major boxes that I've hoped that my career would check. First is practicing and improving primary care like you guys all do. The next one is serving the underserved and helping the most marginalized communities. The third is having a big impact on systems and nations and the world, and that's been important to me from a very young age. And the last one is being a leader and wherever I am. So I think this has actually been kind of the litmus test for everything that I've done and guided a lot of my career decisions and been a North Star for me. So when I think about what that would look like, so if I said, wow, you know, I really want to be, so now I'm a healthcare tech executive. When I go and I look and see who are the healthcare tech executives, so I Googled it. I actually wanted to see like what would come up if I were to search tech company executives. I did not see any Nigerian American immigrant women physicians show up on the list of things. I don't even know why some of the faces here are here, but I didn't see them. And then also I did a similar search for top medical school deans. And again, didn't really see anybody that really looks like me or kind of shares my background. So you would think that, you know, for me, when I was in high school, I remember having a high school counselor at my school in Columbus, Ohio, tell me that I was going to be much more likely to succeed in college if I went as an athlete than instead of going as a scholar. And I've had a lot of people that have decided, based on who I am, what I look like, where I'm from, where my parents are from, the box that I should actually fit in. Right, and so I've been trying very hard to try to kind of make sure I can check my boxes without being put into a box. So when I think about all the check boxes that I've had, the theme of leadership is apparent regardless of kind of what I've done. So I'm going to tell you guys a really interesting story. When I was younger, my maternal grandmother used to always tell me that I had this fire in me, and she would say it sometimes in a good way, sometimes it's not in a good way. And she'd tell me, like, this fire you have, you can use it for bad, and you can use it for good, and I hope you're going to end up using it for good. So I've been trying to use it for good. So one of my fondest stories from my childhood was when I was in second grade. There was a song that I liked so much. I would sing it all the time. And I'm going to date myself here. And some of you in the room are going to know the song when I play it in a moment. I would play it all the time, sing it all the time, and I taught all of my classmates. So I was a leader. I taught all of my classmates how to sing this song. So I'm going to have them put the song up and play the song, but we're just going to hear the first, like, 40 seconds of the song. Second grade. Just remember, second grade. If you know it, you can, you know, snap along. We have to get to the main part that will. See, I know some people, I know you're eight, yeah. So. Okay, we can stop now. Okay. So, second grade. That's the grade my daughter is in right now. So my daughter's in second grade. If my daughter were to come home, or the teacher would call me and say, your daughter has taught the entire class this song, you know, I can imagine how it would act. So, you know, she's going around asking, who taught you guys this? Where did everybody hear this from? Why is everybody singing this song? And they were all like, right here. That's her. Right there. So you have to imagine. So she now said, listen, I'm going to call your parents, and I'm going to tell your parents that you're singing this song. And I said, that's their record. They play that. They sing that with us. I got it from them. You can call them. You know, go ahead. But she said something to me that day that I'll never really forget, and this was in second grade. And she told me that, you know, in a way that a second grader could understand, you know, you're a leader, and what you do, other people are going to do. So make sure you do the right thing. So I continue to try, okay, I've got to just do the right thing. So my kids are probably like, I wouldn't even let my kids hear the song right now. So they're now, this is their first time probably hearing it. So now they're hearing it, but you can see it. So sometimes I really kind of purposefully sought out leadership. You know, when I was in undergrad, I formed an organization that would help minority pre-med students be able to get into medical school and health professional schools. In medical school itself, I was the president of the Student National Medical Association, trying to support minority medical students to kind of get onto residency. In residency, myself and one of my former attendees, Dr. Pablo Ho, who are here, co-founded the diversity committee in the residency program to make sure we can create a safe climate for people of all different backgrounds, orientations, identities while we were in residency. And I've continued kind of that theme of helping and empowering minority women professionals ever since. And I hope that people will see that there's a commitment to leadership in their life. Sometimes it's not really formal and it's not something that you sought out. But sometimes you're looking for this leader to do something, to make the change where you are, to do something powerful, and the leader might be you. And the person that you might be looking for might actually be you and standing right in front of you in the mirror. So a few months ago, I've been thinking a lot about like the leadership that you kind of intentionally do and the things that you don't necessarily intentionally do. A few months ago, I was asked to speak at University of California, Irvine, about racism and sexism in medicine, based on this article that I had written in the Annals of Family Medicine called Racism in Medicine, Shifting the Power, almost 2 years ago. So this was a story, and if you have a chance, please take a look at the story, because I don't have time to go into it today, but it was basically a lot of stuff had happened that day. I was ignored by staff. I had this patient that went into this incredibly racist rant with me, saying that black women are the problem with the world, we're the real doctors, there are niggers everywhere, I'm not letting your black hands touch me. And you can read the whole thing of the story. I ended up journaling it later that day, and then ultimately decided to turn it into a story, and I sent it to the Annals and was totally surprised when they agreed to publish it and felt like it was good to put it out there. But I had written that, so a lot of people were asking me about this experience and can you come and share some of what you've learned about this with our medical students. Right around that time, I don't know if you saw this, this was in the Washington Post, Allison Herbst was the first year resident, general internal medicine resident at Emory in Atlanta, published this article in the Washington Post. And she was talking about sexism that women that are going through training in medicine go through. And she talks about some very, very, very vivid things. And she put this in the Washington Post and, you know, some of the things that she'd heard on the rounds that she was on, you know, and how she felt like this was just kind of permeating the culture entirely. So she had written this, and that was a pretty powerful story. Called her and reached out to her and applauded her for doing it because many people were not doing that. And then right around that time, same thing, another thing happened. You guys had seen this, the Tamika Cross story. I think that's pretty famous now. Black woman doctor was on a flight. A patient was in distress. The Delta airline attendants did not believe that she was a doctor and therefore did not allow her to attend to the patient that was there. And that made headlines all over. But all these things were happening around this time that I was asked to come and talk. So I was asked to come and talk to these students and talk to them about all the different isms and schisms that they're going to go through and how they can handle this and how they can address these things and be prepared to be able to kind of survive and thrive amidst this kind of difficult climate. And I felt like I prepared a lot that was hopefully useful for the students. But what ended up happening was that what was more important was honestly what I didn't say. So this was on Instagram. One of the women who I met that day posted this on Instagram after my talk. I had not met her prior. She said, I shouldn't be this excited about a black woman finally stepping in front of the lecturer's podium at my dear School of Medicine, but I am. Dr. Wanda, which is my handle on Twitter, Instagram, was beautifully elegant, poised, and real AF in her rhetoric today. Thank you for being exactly the presence in medicine that I need. I actually cried when I read this because I said, I can't even believe it. It was just the fact that I was there that was important. It wasn't even really what I said. So I kept thinking about that. Well, what would that be like if she never saw someone like me? So she's an MS3 now. She might have never gone through and never seen a black woman physician ever, right? And that I just was kind of baffled me that could happen. So sometimes for you all, sometimes your presence itself is enough. It doesn't even have to be anything powerful. People sometimes feel like, well, I'm not really ready to be a leader because I don't have those words. I can't speak in public. I can't do this. I can't, you know, manage people. But sometimes your presence is all that matters, just being there. So there are probably some places that you can think about right now that if you were just there, it might accelerate a conversation or change a conversation. Or even just the fact that you're there, people might think of things that they had not. So sometimes I'll just challenge people, just try to be present. And sometimes that presence itself will be leadership. I've had the fortune of having some really good mentors in my life. Dr. Kathleen Klink was the head of family medicine when I was a resident there. Told me that make sure, you know, wherever you go, people will know you're there. I also have had people that have talked to me about kind of what are you going to do in primary care. And I heard earlier that a lot of what I have been doing in primary care has been transforming it. Because primary care right now really needs very grounded, strong, principled, innovative leadership. This is kind of giving you an example. I've told this a lot when I talk about primary care transformation, but when I think about when I was my kid's age, and I used to go to the doctor's office, our family doctor in Columbus, Ohio, and I think about what it looked like, where I went, and I think about where I take them now to go, my kids now to go, nothing really looks that much different. It looks pretty much the same. A couple things are different, but most of it is the same. So we need to really be thankful, obviously, to the people that have pioneered our education, our training, but we also need to think about how are we going to change the way primary care is delivered. What is the primary care that you want to see look like? What is the composition of people that are going to be present and vocal and visible in primary care going to be like for us? For the most part, it feels like the world is changing around us and primary care still kind of stays the same. So a few years ago, I wrote this article in San Francisco Medicine called Bringing Sexy Back to Primary Care. And a lot of people think I made that up, so it depends on your demographic, but I did not make up Bringing Sexy Back. That was a song by Justin Timberlake, and people were, you know, so, but anyway, I claim it, and I wrote this article. One of the things that I had charged in there was that we need to really kind of inspire a new generation of leaders, thinkers, innovators, people that would really, the base of primary care, and really energize this base very, very fast. Because the system that we have is currently unsustainable. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but this was I first saw this back in 2008. And we were saying that in 2020, we're going to have a shortage of 40,000 physicians, primary care physicians, to take care of an aging adult population. 40,000. That was, and we were saying that's going to be 2020. And now we're in 2018. And it's amazing. We're still having this problem. We've not been able to impact the supply very much by opening more medical schools. Because when we open more medical schools, we get more people that go into specialties. And then when we've shortened medical school in some places, and NYU was trying this experiment, but at the same time, we're still not getting the kind of supply that we need, and that people are living longer. We also know that while we've done a good job in family medicine, filling only about 5 to 10% of our slots are not going filled every year, about 50% of those are filled by U.S. medical graduates. Internal medicine, same thing. Their slots are generally close to filled when they have. But we know that less than 25% of those graduates are going to go on into actually practice primary care. We were just chatting about that this morning. And 70% will ultimately specialize or be in the hospital sector. So we know that's going to happen. So even if they're entering primary care or general internal medicine residencies, they don't necessarily ultimately end up practicing that way. We also know that about after 10 years of practice, about half of the physicians in this room are going to experience and report signs of professional burnout. And you're going to have burnout higher than any other U.S. professional worker. So U.S. physicians experience burnout more than any other profession, lawyers, accountants, bankers, nurses, every other profession, than any other, on average. And all the different signs, emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, loss of work-life balance, depression, suicidal ideation. We know that this is going to happen to you. And if you are in family medicine or critical care or emergency medicine, your chances and your risk are much higher. Now, this is not in any way meant to be depressing, but we also know that the composition of the United States is going to look a lot different. And when we talk about that supply thing, this is an issue that we've been dealing with in the Bay Area. We are finding that only 60% of medical students that graduate from UCSF and Stanford, two big schools in the area where I live, go on to residencies. And we know that some people don't want to do residency at all. Some people do residency, but don't want to go into primary care. And at Albert Einstein School of Medicine, Miriam Shapiro published this article kind of about a few years ago about what is the single biggest predictor of what a student will decide what they're going to go into for a residency. What do you guys think of some of those things are? And if you know the paper, you can't say it. What are some of the things that you think will predict why a student would choose a certain residency? What? Debt. Okay, debt. Raise your hand if you have a lot of debt. Okay, I'm kidding. That'd be all of us. We all have it, yeah? So debt is one. What else? Other? Say again? Okay, family background, okay. What else? Lifestyle, okay, a lot of things. So yeah, okay, so those are all the things that I think we would agree on. So the single biggest factor in their study, this was at Albert Einstein, an urban private medical school rather, the strongest factor was the residency, the clerkship experience. So those of you who are clerkship directors and who are directing clerkships and who take students on clerkships, I hope you know this, that this is an incredibly powerful thing. It may not necessarily be the same thing in your environment, but this is a big deal for this particular group. So we've got to make sure that even when we're there, it might not seem like a big deal, but I remember having medical students working with me, and I would be running around and just come with me, just come on, and then realizing, oh my goodness, if this is the experience that they have, what would they want to be me? Then we also know this. So we know that by 2045, the majority-minority ratio in the United States is going to flip. We're going to have an increasingly diverse population in the United States. We know that the women in this room and the minorities in this room are going to be most likely to take care of disadvantaged patients. But we also know that as they do it, they're going to experience a number of different gaps and challenges. We know that there are going to be disparities in pay based on your gender, based on your race and ethnicity. So for me, as an African-American woman, black woman, I'm much more likely to make less than many of the people that I work with and collaborate with on a daily basis. And this is going to be true for in many, many cases, and we know that that's going to happen. We also know that we're going to have the minority physicians, as I mentioned, will provide a lot of care to underserved populations. We know that regardless of how much we do in terms of diversifying our medical schools and our residency programs, that minorities, particularly African-American Hispanics, are going to be underrepresented in both school, in residency, and beyond. This is a pretty interesting look at what happens, kind of the drop-off for women. This is for women in academic medicine. It's pretty exciting when you see the first part of this, where you see that 46%, nearly half of applicants are going to be women, and 47% of matriculants into medical school are going to be women. But if you continue to look at what happens as you go into faculty, then go on to full professors, then go on to deans, about 16% of the deans will be women, which is why when I did that Google search looking for women, women deans, I didn't see that many. And then when you kind of distill this down a little bit more into women of color, about 1.3% of deans and chairs will be women, underrepresented minorities rather. And then even in the hospitals and the large health systems, everything, only 12% will be women at the highest level of leadership across our healthcare center. But why does that really matter? It's staggering. But why does that really matter? So what we know is that one, if people don't see what they think that they can aspire to, they might not aspire to it. So if you don't see what is there, if I go and I'm looking, and I don't see a single woman that is in leadership at the high levels, I would not think that that's a place that I could be. But we also know that women and underrepresented faculty tend to improve public health care access. They expand the research agenda. They improve the learning experience for students and even contribute things that people might not necessarily be thinking about because of the diverse kind of approaches to teaching and learning. So a lot of benefits have been shown to that larger learning environment. So we want to, and then when you ask women, what do they need to succeed? What do you need to actually do well and to advance and to climb? People think that it's like, well, I need more money because you saw those pay gaps, right? If you pay me more, I'll be happy, right? That's what people think we would say, but that's not what we say. When they ask us, what do you actually need to do well, women, to be able to do well in these environments? What we say is that I want to be really clear about what this path for advancement is. I want to just have clarity, like, what is it? What are the steps? I don't want to know, I need to know if there's stuff that is kind of hiding, that secret that's under the table that only certain people know. I want to know it, just put it on the table. I also want an equitable and diverse workplace. I work better when there's diversity in thought, in background, in orientation, in heritage. I work better when I have that diversity around me. And I want access to the opportunities that everybody has access to, the opportunities to really advance. I want to have the same access to those. And those are the things that women say when WMC does this Faculty Forward survey. This is what they actually ask for. So as you start to think about it, I will tell you a little bit of my position. I left my position in academia, my primary position in academia, almost a year ago, to pursue a career in private sector in health technology company. I did it for a number of reasons. But one of those reasons was that I felt like it was a major opportunity to be part of this important tide in technology that could either sink primary care or lift primary care. I had already been a chief medical officer of a large FQHC. I'd already been at UCSF, as you heard, the director of the Center for Excellence in Primary Care. And I was really excited about contributing to the scholarly practice and advancement of primary care and practice transformation. But I kept on seeing something that wasn't going away while I was in that box. I kept thinking, like, we needed to purge and kind of redo kind of the way we do things in primary care. I talked to this man, Arushika Fernandopoul, who's the founder of Iora Health, which is really disrupting kind of a primary care model, providing people with a high ratio of medical assistants, health coaches, and support, and then a primary care provider, but 3-to-1. So you've got three other people, and then this, and they're all over and kind of disrupting. I was talking with him, and I said, well, what made, this was a few years ago, I said, what made you kind of just do this? And he said, you know, I felt like we keep on putting Band-Aids on primary care. We just keep putting Band-Aids on. And I wanted to just kind of blow it up and do the whole new thing entirely. So I had a vision that I could also try to maybe stop putting Band-Aids and try to fix a broken system, how to leverage tech to empower underserved communities. So I took a huge pay cut, and you remember I'm married with two kids, and kind of took my life in a very different direction. And I'm, you know, right now I'm glad I did. So I want you to repeat after me. Check the boxes, but don't get put in the box. I knew that my peer group was small. There are very few people that had made that kind of leap and forged this new path. At the time that I was entering tech, what we were seeing is like, why are women and blacks and Hispanics leaving tech? Like, get out of there. This is like, if you think it's bad, you know, these disparities and where you are, like, it's much worse over here in tech. That was what I was kind of entering in. A lot of people felt like, oh, she's headed down this invisible path. What is she doing? I had a lot of people that had very strong words for me about the decision that I had. That I made, but I also had some really good, kind words. Mark Greenwald, who many of you guys know at Virginia Caroline School of Medicine, and I had the pleasure of having dinner soon after I made this decision, and described, said, you know, wow, you know, really inspiring that you're going to take all you've learned and take it into this new space. Dr. Joan Reed, who is the first African-American woman to be a dean at Harvard Medical School and my mentor, where I did my fellowship under her Commonwealth Fund Fellowship in Minority Health Policy, she kept telling me, when I was talking to her about this decision I was going to make, just keep going where you're going and don't be scared. You're not going to see people that look like you where you are, but you need to go there so people can start to see you. So I went. So only time is going to tell, you know, whether I made the right move or not. But my kids think I'm really cool. So, like, you know, if nothing else, right? At least for now, they think that I'm pretty cool. And my mom always says, no education is wasted. No experience is ever wasted. So for my future primary care leaders in here, how many of you feel like you're in a box? Be honest. Yeah, some people feel like they're in a box. And how many people feel like they know what those check boxes are for them? Like, who knows? Like, what are those things that I think are the constants that really guide me and when I'm thinking about what I'm going to do? So a few of you know. Okay, that's fantastic. I mean, it's kind of scary to forge a path that you can't see, right? That, like, you know, something that you're going to do that nobody has done before. You can't quite see, like, what it's going to end up like or what it will ultimately look like. You know, it's hard to kind of do that. But once you kind of know what those checkboxes are and kind of have a North Star for your own career, then it is a little bit less scary. So I'm going to argue that you guys are all leaders in this room, whether by choice, by accident, by force, or by Facebook. And this is, I love this cartoon. You base your leadership experience on your followers and Twitter and your likes on Facebook. But in this generation, that might actually be how people interpret it. But we are all leaders, and I think that this is the next generation of leadership that primary care is depending on. We actually need to think about primary care, and particularly for family medicine, for those of them in family medicine, because of the way we think. We need to be in education and academia. We need to be innovating in laboratories, medical device companies, pharmaceutical companies, in government, in housing authorities, in community clinics, in free clinics, in public health agencies, social service agencies, transportation agencies. I have a really good friend who's a family doctor who's working for transportation department in D.C. and really actually interestingly drawing very incredible parallels between kind of equity in healthcare and housing and transportation. But we need a true family medicine revolution outside of the box. Get us outside of those boxes that we've been in for so long. Who's this? Who feels like this sometimes? Yeah, this is something someone's saying. But I think that as family medicine doctors, we have to tap into that both that power that we have and the pride that we should have. Sometimes we let ourselves be kind of bullied or minimized in the grand hierarchy of medicine. You know, people, and I know this has happened to you guys, but this has happened to me, you know, many, many times. Oh, you're too smart to go into family medicine. Why did you do that? Right? You know, and when you're going to go to present your patient case to a specialist, you're kind of like, as a family doctor, you're like, oh gosh, they're going to yell at me. They're going to think I'm stupid. But we have an incredible amount of power because of the way we think. We don't think about people as just the person that walked into their office and the ICD-9 code that they have on their medical list. We think about the whole equation, who they are in the context of their family, the environment that they live in, the socio-political circumstances that they are embedded in, who their children are, who their grandparents are or were. We think about all of that. And so for family medicine, we don't just think about the individuals, we think about the populations. We've been doing that since the beginning. We think about the neighborhoods that they come from. This is part of the way we're educated. And that is incredibly, incredibly powerful. So I think we need to really take pride in that and think about that and how we kind of get people to their full potential. We also have to think about how our leadership is when we are. We have to be the kind of leader that we would want to follow. So if I'm yelling and barking and screaming and everything at the people that I'm leading, then why would anybody want to do that? So we have to think about that. So I'm speaking mostly to the educators in the room. Try to be the kind of leader that you want your students, your residents, your junior faculty, your people coming behind you to follow. But for those of you that are coming up, you guys need to push us and hold us accountable. Now, the system that I showed you, where we are with the burnout and the shortage and, you know, the kind of stressors that we have, we kind of started that. So you guys have to fix it, okay? Because we clearly need some help to fix it. We need to create safe spaces for people of diverse backgrounds to feel safe and be able to say, I'm from an LGBTQ background, I'm from a non-dominant religion, I'm from this racial and ethnic minority group, and I have a safe place here. And I can be a leader, and I can grow, I can be developed, I can be encouraged. I'm happy to talk about some of that work about it. But you guys have to hold us accountable. We can't just keep talking about it. We have to be about it. You guys have to make us be about it. And don't take no for an answer. You can go to your, you know, go to their chair and say, how come we don't have a more representative faculty than you know, that represents where we are? How come we don't have that? You can absolutely do that. Push us, hold us accountable. We also need to help you check your boxes and not keep putting you in the box. And we have, I mean, many of us are mentors in the room. We have people, we have ideas, we see them, we think, oh, she would be so great at this, or he'd be so great at that. But we have to be careful not to impose kind of our vision for someone else's life on them and help them check their boxes. So I want to ask people again the question that we started with, really, who are you? Who do you want to be? How will you lead? And how do you want to finish the sentence when someone asks you again, particularly when they ask you to do it with the value prop? Good morning, my name is, and I wish everybody in this room the absolute best as you check your boxes. I hope you can help us build the next century primary care that you want to see and that you all deserve. And as I said in the beginning, I'm a crazy Ohio State fan. This is my kids with Brutus Buckeye. And this is my niece and nephew that are here today with me. I want to just acknowledge my entire family. Can you guys stand up real quick? All of them that came. And that's it. I'll stop. So I'll take questions and just appreciate everybody's attention this morning. Thank you so much. Thank you.